This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. Written by Joe Selvin, with Pamela Turley. Read by John Glushevich. Includes a Mac and PC-compatible PDF of photos. Dedication. To Bobby, Phil, Mickey, and Billy, and all the Deadheads. Chapter 1. Board Meeting. Christ, not Garcia. Nobody expected that. True, everybody on the plane had heard him wheezing when he fell asleep on the flight home from the band's last concert at Soldier Field in Chicago. But his death in August 1995 had come as a complete and sudden shock to all his bandmates and their organization. The Deadheads, especially the canny older guard of the band's exceptionally knowing, caring fans, were not so surprised. Many had stopped coming to shows after Garcia returned from his diabetic coma in 1987. They were heartbroken as they watched his waistline explode, his health deteriorate, and his once unparalleled skills on guitar disintegrate. As the band's performances through the 90s continued to devolve, with Garcia's personal problems increasingly apparent, and their audiences almost inexplicably still growing beyond imagination, some simply stopped attending, convinced they were watching him kill himself. Just as no other band had ever been like the Grateful Dead, Jerry Garcia had been like no other band leader. He was the philosophical axis, the virtuoso guitar player, the father figure, the best friend. In fact, each one of the four surviving members thought that he alone had been Garcia's best friend. They held no such illusions about each other. Garcia was their true north. Since they were young men, they had set their compasses to him. His death hit them like a sledgehammer. But in the uncertain and bewildering days after Garcia's death, it wasn't just the loss of friendship with him that they had to mourn. Their entire foundation had come loose, and they were jolted by the harsh realities that had suddenly intruded into their lives. Distraught and fearful, uncertain of the future, canceling engagements, laying off loyal crew, these men had barely seen each other since the funeral, couldn't bring themselves to. Each one had largely disappeared into his own world. 4 months went by after Garcia's death before the four surviving members could muster the will to meet and decide what to do about the beast called the Grateful Dead that had ruled their lives for the better part of four decades. After 30 years of touring, the band ached from a deep weariness that almost no one but their road crew could understand. Over the years, they had realized the Grateful Dead was bigger than all of them, had a life of its own, and created its own momentum. But could it survive without the visionary leadership of its founding father? There had been many lean years in the history of the Dead, but by the time of Garcia's death, they were playing to stadiums full of paying customers in every city in the country, and it was hard not to go out and pick up the money. They had come to enjoy the charter jets, limousines, and five-star hotels. Band members, along with crew and staff, were settling down, getting married, raising families, buying expensive homes. Their employees numbered more than 60, many of whom had been on the trip for decades. The band's so-called career was largely an accident. The Grateful Dead never sought success. They saw themselves as musicians. They played music. The actual business of a rock and roll band was a mystery to them, and they couldn't be bothered with it. They didn't think in terms of wealth and fame. They hadn't sought it and didn't know how to value it. Eventually, they realized if they were going to manage their organization and continue to do what they loved, they had to come to terms with the commerce, and they made a grudging, uneasy peace with it. More than any other rock band, the Grateful Dead had enjoyed freedom from highly structured and rigid business practices. Instead of corporate bylaws, they had lived by a code vigilantly observed, which had served to create the Grateful Dead ethos. They had largely been able to approach life on their own terms, but with the level of success they had stumbled into, that carefree attitude was no longer possible. The band members and their most trusted associates showed up on Thursday morning, December 7th, at the band's old Victorian in downtown San Rafael that had served as their headquarters for more than 30 years. The new Novato headquarters on Belmer and Keys Road was not quite ready. They were there for a meeting of the board of directors of Grateful Dead Productions, the corporate arm of the famed psychedelic rock band. They were weighed down with grief, the burden of having to decide the fate of not only themselves, but of all the people who depended on the organization for their livelihood. Their long-suffering staff stood by anxiously. Drummer Billy Kreutzmann still couldn't bring himself to attend and stayed behind in Hawaii. It would be the last board meeting at the Lincoln Street complex, held in the upstairs room in an auxiliary building across the street from the ramshackle two-story gabled house on the quiet corner. In typical Grateful Dead fashion, the band had rented the building since they first moved to Marin County and had only recently purchased the former Coca-Cola bottling plant in nearby Novato, where the band's thriving merchandise enterprise had already been located under a rental agreement for several years, and where the entire Grateful Dead operation would now be centered. Just before he died, Garcia had visited the new rehearsal hall and offices and given his approval. For the last 10 years, the band had been the leading box office attraction in rock, pulling down a hard-to-believe $370 million in gate receipts over the decade. Now, that roaring river of revenue had come to a sudden and complete halt. The operation was in immediate economic freefall. They had already scrubbed an East Coast tour, scheduled to start in September, and laid off their 30-person road crew. Between the office and the band's merchandise business, there were still another 30 employees. Like many families protecting an addict in their midst, the Dead had lived in denial over Garcia's health issues. They had survived one near-death episode years before, but carried on while Garcia continued to sink deeper into the abyss. He had struggled for 10 years with his heroin addiction. Only band management knew that he had secretly made plans to enter rehab at the Betty Ford Clinic after Soldier Field that July. The management team had questioned among themselves whether the September tour would happen. Garcia, chafing against the detailed routine, bolted Betty Ford after a few days, but had checked into another treatment facility in Marin County when he was found dead in the middle of the night. With such a large organization, it would make sense that a financial plan would have been in place to cover unexpected catastrophic events, such as the death of the leader. Yet nothing like a plan had ever been developed. The Grateful Dead operated like a minimum wage worker, living paycheck to paycheck, without preparation for the future, acting like things would never change. They had worked for years, but had little to show for it, other than expansive lifestyles and large debts. With a number of Dead employees already gone and more layoffs booming, Garcia's death forced instant hardships on those he left behind. These were mostly people who had labored beside the band for 30 years or more. The egalitarian Dead treated them like family. They paid salaries well above the industry norm and extended all kinds of financial assistance to their people. When a fallen redwood tree crushed manager Cameron Sears' home, during a New Year's Eve show while the house was vacant, the band loaned him the money for repairs. The band routinely extended cash advances to crew and employees and then carried the debt on the books for years. Such generosity was typical of the Dead. The type of loyalty the band members showed the people who worked for them was rare in the music industry, and these layoffs cut them to the core. Guitarist Bob Weir and bassist Phil Lesh had attended the first company meeting within 2 weeks of Garcia's death, conducted by band attorney Hal Kant. The first round of layoffs, where anybody who had worked with the band less than 10 years was let go. They hung around after the meeting to commiserate. "This place has been a haven for the chronically unemployed," Weir told the band's computer specialist Bob Brailove, whose relatively recent hiring meant he did not make the first cut. "You'll be all right." The layoffs only heightened the emotional toll on this traumatized group. There was no consensus on what to do. Weir, along with drummer Mickey Hart, eager to return to performing, had committed to a summer tour to be called the Further Festival, which would feature a repertory-style program that included Hot Tuna, featuring Jefferson Airplane alumni Jorma Kaukonen and Jack Cassidy. The East Los Angeles Chicano rockers Los Lobos, who were a favorite of Garcia's, former Dead sideman Bruce Hornsby, and others. It was a hurried and unorganized effort to find employment for at least some of the crew and help cover lost income for some of the Dead's concert promoters across the country. Phil Lesh, sick of strenuous touring and father of two young sons, wanted to stay home, raise his kids, and have nothing to do with any future performances. Kreutzmann, one of the two drummers in the band, who initially had dived into a bottle, went through rehab, divorced his wife, and vanished to Kauai, where he was surfing and scuba diving. He didn't even take a drum kit with him. When Garcia died, Weir was in New Hampshire, touring with his solo band, Rat Dog. He played the show that night and returned to California the next day for the funeral, leaving his band and crew waiting in an East Coast hotel for the tour to resume the next week. The band had evolved out of a collaboration with bassist Bob Wasserman, originally called Scaring the Children, and had only recently added drummer Jay Lane. Garcia's death was announced the morning of Lane's third date with the band. After the funeral, Weir went right back on the road and stayed. He was only in town for the fateful board meeting, flying to Las Vegas for a gig that night. Mickey Hart had been sequestered in the recording studio in his Sonoma County ranch with an ambitious solo album, a monstrously complex project that Garcia had known about and encouraged. The drummer brought in British producer Robin Miller, best known for his ultra-sleek production with soul singer Sade, to finish the record. Miller smoothed Hart's massive percussion overdubs into silken Europop sonics, heightened by a British female vocal group, the Mint Juleps, along with some powerful songs from Dead lyricist Robert Hunter. The album brimmed with exquisite instrumental tracks and sublime vocal textures. Titled Mystery Box, the record became a far more polished and fully realized piece of work than any previous solo album from members of the Dead, and, astonishingly enough, sounded like a record that could be a hit. Hart later said that making the album saved his life. Such was the emotional landscape when the band members dully crowded their cars into the tiny, cramped parking spaces behind the back of the house. Grateful Dead Productions CEO and band manager Cameron Sears was to chair the meeting. The band's chief financial officer, the straight-laced former banker Nancy Maloney, was there. Hal Kant attended, as did the head of Grateful Dead merchandise, the band's direct mail operation, Peter McQuaid. The two remaining members of the road crew, Steve Parrish and Ramrod, came. They had already announced they would be pooling their salary and sharing it equally with their crewmate, Kid Condelario, to keep him on the payroll. Keyboardist Vince Welnick, who just joined the band 5 years before and was given a full share from day one, was the only one wearing tie-dye. Sears' assistant, Jan Simmons, would take the minutes of the meeting. Even lyricist Hunter, hardly an organization man, came. Publicist Dennis McNally hovered around in case they needed to draft a press release. The atmosphere was grim and hardly chatty. In the boardroom, sitting in one of the dozen custom chairs, one arm draped over the signature armrests hand-carved with the Steely, the skull and lightning bolts trademark of the Dead, was Phil Lesh. His sock-clad feet rested on the massive 20-foot antique oak table the band brought back from Germany on their 1972 European tour. He rolled an unlit cigar in his mouth. The band members knew each other well. They had, quite literally, grown up together. Weir had joined the band at age 16. Lesh, the oldest, was almost 10 years older. After almost a decade of chaos and touring in 1974, the band took a year-long hiatus. They came back together, having come to accept the role the Dead played in their lives, and settled into a remarkably steady, harmonious collaboration with Garcia at the helm. There had been the typical miscellaneous arguments and shifting alliances, but no major political disputes inside the Grateful Dead. The entire world seemed to be aware of the band's predicament. Hart and Lesh had attended a fundraising lunch for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, and the president asked about their plans. Since shortly after Garcia's death, rumors had been flying about his replacement. David Hidalgo of Los Lobos, Neil Young, Carlos Santana, Jorma Kaukonen, and Mark Knopfler were all mentioned. The band heard the rumors, and so did the guitarists named, but there was no basis in fact. There were no plans. Nothing had been seriously discussed. The four musicians had only seen each other once since the funeral and the Golden Gate Park Memorial 2 days later. They held a brief meeting a couple of days after, sitting around one of the front offices at the new place in Novato, vaguely tossing around some thoughts, but mostly staring at their shoes and enduring the awkward silences. Nobody thought the idea of continuing as the Grateful Dead sounded right, especially Kreutzmann, but nobody had the belly to deal with anything but the most fundamental business, certainly not facing any difficult issues at that early stage. 4 months later, this board meeting would have to address the question. It seemed almost sacrilegious to consider replacing Garcia, but there was a need among the band to come to some decision. These men were tired, bereaved, frustrated, and scared with the enormous weight of the massive Grateful Dead organization on their shoulders, and without Garcia, no idea how they were going to hold it up. The meeting was called to order before a standing room only crowd. There were many items on the agenda, but staring everybody in the face was the most basic decision that needed to be made about the band's future, how they would continue. Discussion was relatively brief. Cameron Sears, who never met a decision he would not rather postpone, argued that no decision need be made. Welnick, who had been flat broke when he was hired by the band and had become greatly enamored of the Dead lifestyle, enthusiastically supported getting the band back on the road as soon as possible. Talking from a speakerphone, Kreutzmann put the matter to rest. "I'm not going to tour anymore," he said. With Kreutzmann's simple declarative statement, Lesh no doubt felt a sense of relief flood through him. He, too, must have been tired of the Grateful Dead hamster wheel. Maybe they weren't ready to pull the plug on their careers, but Kreutzmann's words were liberating. The overwhelming sense that they couldn't continue without Garcia took over the meeting. Nobody had the drive or interest in remodeling the band. It seemed to them that their long, strange trip had finally come to an end. Hunter stood up to speak. More than anybody except Garcia, Hunter had been responsible for creating the Grateful Dead. While Garcia was the undisputed genius musician and bandleader, Hunter's job was to articulate the vision, to detail out the dead world in his songs. He had risen to the occasion many times. A crusty, whimsical, professorial sort not given to getting involved in band business, Hunter remained outside the day-to-day turmoil and rarely deigned to express himself. Standing to speak, he had the room's attention. Hunter simply quoted a couplet from the end of his song, Fire on the Mountain. "The more that you give, why, the more it will take," he said, "to the thin line beyond which you really cannot fake." Then he walked out. The meeting moved on. Much business needed to be conducted, decisions that had been set aside for the past 4 months. The band members had held almost daily telephone conversations with the front office, but spoke with each other very little. Counselor Kant raised an issue about Garcia's will that concerned him. In the will, Garcia bequeathed the custom-made guitars he played back to the man who made them. Kant was certain that the guitars were purchased with Grateful Dead Productions funds and, consequently, belonged to the band. He wanted to take steps to make sure the guitars did not get away. Some of the musicians didn't understand that the band owned their instruments, let alone Garcia's. Garcia himself probably hadn't known. Publicist McNally was summoned, and he quickly composed a press release. A trained academician who landed his job because Garcia liked his Jack Kerouac biography, Desolate Angel, McNally hardly turned out typical press mill copy. It was a brief statement, tinged with poetry and regret, but it effectively closed the door on the future of the Grateful Dead. For immediate release. The wheel is turning, and you can't slow down. You can't let go, and you can't hold on. You can't go back, and you can't stand still. The Wheel, Robert Hunter. After 4 months of heartfelt consideration, the remaining members of the band met yesterday and came to the conclusion that the long, strange trip of the uniquely wonderful beast known as the Grateful Dead is over. Although individually and in various combinations, they will continue to make music, whatever the future holds will be something different in name and structure. In making this announcement, band members were especially mindful of their partners in this adventure, the Deadheads, urging them to remember that the music, the values, and the spirit of this marvelous shared journey endure. Business operations will continue at the band's longtime Marin offices. The release would go out the next morning. Would that it could be so simple. Chapter 2. Terrapin Station. Like many Deadheads, Rick Abelson was consumed by grief over the death of Jerry Garcia. Unlike most, he was in a position to act on his bereavement. Abelson, who attended his first Dead concert in 1977 while growing up in New Jersey, was a Harvard School of Design trained landscape architect who specialized in theme parks. He had built attractions and designed exhibits all over Asia and Latin America, remodeled American amusement parks, and consulted on projects around the world. His profession put him far outside the realm of the Grateful Dead, but Abelson was about to converge with the band in ways he could not have predicted. Garcia's death shook him, and as he thought about what the other band members were going to do without their leader, Abelson began to develop the germ of an idea. He sketched out his thoughts for a Grateful Dead exhibition that would recreate the atmosphere of the Dead concerts without the band itself. He called it the Grateful Dead Experience. In October 1995, only weeks after Garcia died, Abelson sent his quickly improvised plans, some notes, and a few drawings, eyewash in the parlance of his trade, unsolicited to the Grateful Dead office in San Rafael. His cover letter outlined a vague proposed idea detailing how the surviving members could move forward into the future without Garcia, a kind of museum-slash-theme park. Abelson held out no special hope for the proposal. It was something he did to make himself feel better, and to offer a small contribution, perhaps, but mostly to work out his own feelings through the design process, something he had learned to do over his years in the field. What Abelson didn't know was that the Grateful Dead had fancifully considered such an idea for years. The band, weary of the drudgery of touring, loved to talk about having a home base of sorts, often bringing up the subject among themselves in the middle of the concerts. The musicians would spin fantasies of establishing a headquarters where they could play music without having to travel and let the audience come to them. It was the kind of wishful thinking that nourished their spirit, a joking pastime the band members indulged over the years. As far back as the 70s, the band struggled with the whole idea of traveling from hockey rink to hockey rink, playing music in the most uncongenial environments imaginable, and enduring extraordinary hardships simply to get to the stage where they could finally play the music. One-time manager Ron Rakow, one of the shiftiest characters in a Grateful Dead past littered with shifty characters, used to keep plans posted on his office wall above his desk for an inflatable amphitheater that would simply float from concert to concert. In case those drawings didn't adequately impress visitors, he also posted a letter from acclaimed genius of the day, Buckminster Fuller, agreeing to consider certain aspects of the project if it ever got going. The floating arena idea never went anywhere, But the dead always kept their eyes open for innovative alternatives to the conventional system of touring. Abelson had no way of knowing that his package dovetailed with this long-standing fantasy of the band, more hallucination than vision. But probably only the goofy Grateful Dead would have even explored a crazy idea dropped on their desk over the transom from someone they never met. After consideration and discussion at the San Rafael office, Cameron Spears picked up the phone and reached Abelson. Not expecting to hear back at all, Abelson was more than surprised by Spears' phone call and that he was summoned for a meeting. He showed up at the Lincoln Street offices on December 5th, one day prior to the board meeting where the band decided to retire the Grateful Dead. By this time, Abelson had brought aboard Economics Research Associates, ERA, the firm founded in 1958 by Harrison Buzz Prince, the Stanford MBA graduate who did all the research and planning for Disneyland. After that, the firm was a principal in virtually every major theme park development around the world. Abelson and the two ERA associates, Steve Spickard and Jim McCarthy from the firm's San Francisco office, knew not to wear their neckties. They parked behind the shady Victorian in downtown San Rafael and were greeted cheerily by Sears' assistant, Jan Simmons. "You're on time," she said. "That's not very rock and roll." They walked into the kitchen, where Simmons seated them at a table for the meeting. Office manager Eileen Law met them. The kitchen was the nerve center of the hive. The ladies who ran the Grateful Dead office located their desks in the kitchen, where nobody ever really cooked. A sign above one desk read, "Do you want to talk to the man in charge or the woman who knows what's going on?" Hal Kant, the band's rough-hewn lawyer with the business cards reading "Legally Dead," had flown in from Reno, where he had been playing poker. He was a world champion poker player and pursued the activity with fierce devotion. Kant, a right-wing, old-fashioned conservative, was an unusual associate for the hippie rock group, but he was unswervingly loyal and vigilant in his representation of the band. He was first hired by the band with the stipulation that they would be his only music business client, and he had stayed true to his word. He and Cameron Spears were joined by band member Phil Lesh, who not only enthusiastically greeted the design research team, but immediately informed them that he had a name for what they were planning: Terrapin Station. Abelson outlined his vision. He exuded confidence and energy. He saw nothing but success. He said the Dead Museum project was a slam dunk. "You forget who you were talking to," said Eileen Law. "The Grateful Dead?" "Yeah," said Lesh. "If anybody can screw it up, we can." The meeting migrated upstairs to the more clubby mood of manager Sears' office. Abelson explained the concept of charrette to the Dead people. Originally drawn from the French word for the carts that collected final papers at the last minute from students at Paris's École des Beaux-Arts in the 19th century, in the design community, the term had come to refer to the collaborative process of quickly collecting input from a number of people. He wanted to arrange such a workshop session with the Dead folks as soon as possible. They came to terms, and the Dead agreed to underwrite the modest budget. Three nights later, 2 days after laying the Grateful Dead to rest, Phil Lesh appeared on an early internet broadcast called Grateful Web with Dead tape archivist Dick Latvala. Such internet events were in such a fledgling state that the press release felt compelled to advise anybody who wanted to participate that you need a computer with an internet hookup and a graphic browser to read the World Wide Web. They were celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Dead's first appearance at the Fillmore Auditorium. Latvala's archival CD series, Dick's Picks, had already proved a surprisingly strong source of unexpected revenue, with orders arriving at the band's headquarters in the mail daily and experiencing a strong boost in sales following Garcia's death. Lesh and Latvala were sampling tracks from Latvala's two most recent releases, 100 Year Hall and Dick's Picks Volume 3. 3 days after meeting with designers, an enthusiastic Lesh was already talking about celebrating the band's legacy and culture through some kind of institution. Some kind of gathering place, Lesh said, perhaps to be called Terrapin Station. He envisioned a meeting place for people to continue the Grateful Dead experience without the band actually having to perform. He mentioned a performing space and virtual reality rooms, a combination of computer technology and audio science, with Grateful Dead music and videos playing continually. San Francisco is the most logical place for it, he said, but we are entertaining offers from elsewhere. Lesh had no plans for the band to play. We want to have a place where deadheads can come and recapture as much of that experience as they can without actually having a live performance, Lesh said. In March 1996, Rick Abelson showed up for his charrette over 2 days at the Wyndham Hotel near San Rafael. He immediately saw Dead Roadies Ramrod and Steve Parrish wandering around like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern looking lost in the lobby. The conference rooms had been reserved under a fake name, so there was no sign directing guests to Grateful Dead Museum Meeting. Instead, the board in the lobby listed a family reunion under a phony name that Ramrod and Parrish didn't recognize. Abelson introduced himself and led the two rock and roll cowboys to the meeting. The Grateful Dead Productions office had pulled together more than a dozen guests that included not only Phil Lesh and the band's senior business advisors, but also key players such as lighting director Candace Brightman and audio engineer John Cutler. Long-standing office manager Eileen Law and her daughter Cassidy, who was married to band manager Cameron Sears, also attended, as did fan newsletter editor Gary Lambert and broadcaster David Gans of the widely syndicated Grateful Dead Hour. Also attending was a golfing buddy of Hal Kant's, a former Silicon Valley attorney named Neil Kumsky, who had helped a client of Kant's acquire some oil fields in Costa Rica. Kumsky flew in from New Jersey for the meet and had everybody thinking he was some sort of gangster showing up all dressed in black. Kant had him in mind as a kind of project manager. They sat around a table and, beginning with Abelson, introduced themselves to the group. Lesh was third. "I'm Phil Lesh," he said, "and I'm an out-of-work musician." Abelson spent the day collecting ideas from the group. He and Spickard and McCarthy from ERA were there to hear from these people, plumb their thoughts on what this project could be, how the band's legacy could be reflected and contained inside four walls. They made notes on whiteboards. They listened as the panel considered many aspects of the idea. How big would it be? Where would it be? What components would it need to connect with the Grateful Dead experience? Abelson encouraged free-flowing dialogue, looking to get at the essence of why people would go to Grateful Dead concerts. He madly scribbled notes and recorded everything. After the exhaustive session led into the evening and dispersed, Abelson, McCarthy, and Spickard huddled in the hotel bar. Abelson had brought a renderer from his office in Los Angeles and had dispatched the sketch artist to his room to work up some drawings based on the day's discussions. Spickard finally retreated to his room around midnight, leaving Abelson and McCarthy to close the bar. Abelson finally made his way back to his room to supervise the final touches of the drawings his renderer was making. They cut pictures out of books. They stayed up all night putting their presentation together. At 6 in the morning, they took the sketches to a nearby Kinko's and made giant color enlargements of the original drawings. The man working behind the counter had read in the local paper about a secret meeting by the Grateful Dead and figured out the connection between the news report and his early morning customers, but he played it cool. When the panel of experts returned for the second day, most of them anyway, they were greeted with the huge color sketches laid out on the conference table. The facade of the building had been drawn to look like San Francisco's Warfield Theater, surrounded by the scaffolding fashioned to hold the Dead's historic experimental sound system called the Wall of Sound, Garcia's face at the center of a giant video screen. There was a drawing of the Dancing Bear Cafe, the rooftop restaurant envisioned the day before. As the meeting came to order, Abelson taped the blow-ups to the wall, but Ramrod was so fascinated he squatted down, inspecting the details. The sketches drew from the previous day's discussion, but now that the ideas were gloriously visualized and embellished, the project seemed even more plausible. The drawings offered a glimpse at the reality of a Grateful Dead museum, no longer just a joke for Dead insiders, but something tangible. Abelson had smashed a home run with his audience, who buzzed excitedly for the rest of the day about the prospects and possibilities. Yet they gave Abelson no direct instructions on what to do next. They figured he knew. After a complete stop, the museum plans came as part of an unexpectedly hectic schedule as the band sought to come out into the sunlight after agreeing to call an end to the Grateful Dead. The merchandise wing was experiencing brisk sales of the Dick's Pick CDs, and plans to roll out a more robust release schedule were underway. Weir's Rat Dog and Hart's Mystery Box, the band that played on the album of the same name, had been announced even before the board meeting in December as headline attractions on the further festival summer tour. It was also announced that Lesh, Weir, Hart, and Vince Welnick would be joining the San Francisco Symphony for a new music festival in June. Lesh and Hart appeared in January at the ceremonies at New York's Waldorf Astoria to induct their colleagues Jefferson Airplane into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Lesh was ideally suited to lead the band's exploration of the museum project. A conscientious parent of two young sons, Lesh also struggled with serious health issues. He had been dealing with the ravages of hepatitis C for years, but it wasn't getting better. He was frankly relieved to be off the road and have the Grateful Dead touring regimen off his back. He could drive his kids to school in the morning. He was taking one of the boys to summer camp when he first received word of Garcia's death, and preside over the evening family meal, prepared by his wife, Jill, and even lead the family sing-alongs after dinner. Lesh had no stomach to return to the stage. He told the band he was retiring. He intended to concentrate on projects like Terrapin Station that would keep him home. In another project waiting for him at home in those desperate days following Garcia's death, Lesh undertook the investigation of the Dead's unfinished album project. The band had been recording a new album in starts and stops, beginning with sessions in November 1994 at the site, a remote, high-end Marin County recording studio in the woods down the road from George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch. Many of the songs had been thoroughly road-tested in concert. So Many Roads, Days Between, Samba in the Rain, Liberty. But Garcia had only laid down rudimentary guitar parts, no solos, and his indifferent vocals were little more than placeholders for the real performances that would now never come. Lesh went in the studio in January to see if there was anything that could be done with the tapes, but quickly concluded there was not enough to salvage any kind of serious album release. He was not surprised. But any disappointment he felt was ameliorated by being able to go home and sleep in his own bed every night. His bandmate, Bob Weir, on the other hand, did everything he could to stay away from home. Garcia's death came at the start of an East Coast tour by Rat Dog, and Weir had simply stashed his band and crew in a hotel while he returned to California for the funeral and memorial, going back to the scheduled dates the following week, almost as if nothing had happened. Rat Dog started as an attempt for Weir to define himself outside the Grateful Dead. The band featured no lead guitar, he was not performing Dead material, and instead concentrated on blues and even occasional 50s pop standards, such as Fever or Twilight Time. But it quickly became his lifeboat. In many ways, of all the Dead musicians, Weir was the most shaken by Garcia's death. The little brother suddenly abandoned by his protector and benefactor. But he would work out his grief on the road, tirelessly grinding out a series of shows with his band for the entire month after Garcia died in August 1995, and again with another several weeks on tour in November and December. Performances that were as much therapy sessions as concerts, for the audience as well as Weir. He started the band with his Mill Valley neighbor, Rob Wasserman, a gifted bassist and musician with whom he had occasionally played as a duo over the previous 10 years. Wasserman was a formidable figure who recorded his own unique 1998 album of bass duets with vocalists such as Aaron Neville, Ricky Lee Jones, and Bobby McFerrin. He had toured with Lou Reed and played with Garcia's bluegrass buddy, mandolinist David Grisman, among many others. A serious, even dour artistic type, ironically known as Chuckles around the Stoner Grisman camp, conservatory-trained Wasserman favored the subtleties of the acoustic bass. Rat Dog also included harmonica player Matt Kelly, a childhood friend of Weir's. Kelly and Weir had played together in his band Kingfish during the 70s. Weir appeared on the first two Kingfish albums while the Dead were on hiatus in 1974. Kelly never left Weir's orbit, guesting on occasional Dead sessions and remaining friends until they came together again in Rat Dog. They added 31-year-old drummer Jay Lane just prior to Garcia's death. A former member of quirky metal trio Primus, led by bassist Les Claypool, Lane had been part of informal composing sessions that Weir had been holding at his house for a musical he was writing about pitcher Satchel Paige of the Negro Baseball League. When Rat Dog returned from the East Coast swing, Weir expanded the roster to include Dead keyboardist Welnick, although he soon grew alarmed at Welnick's mental state. Three previous keyboard players for the Dead had already died. They chose Welnick after a short audition of five candidates, largely because he could sing the high notes. The band had no desire to drag themselves through the extensive process to find someone great. Someone good enough would do. With the Dead, Welnick had been an agreeable bandmate and something of an innocuous presence in the group, eager to please and capable enough. But touring with Rat Dog, Welnick appeared to be going through a personality change. Riding on a bus on a string of dates through the West in December 1995, Weir found himself moving to the rear of the coach to get away from Welnick, who had taken to riding for miles, staring silently ahead, a thin, eerie smile plastered on his face. Weir privately told Jay Lane that this wasn't the same Vince that he knew from the Dead. When he auditioned for the Grateful Dead, Welnick had been sleeping in a barn and planning to move to Mexico. He had enthusiastically embraced his leap into the major leagues and the exciting world of touring with the band. But since Garcia's death, he had fallen into a dark, depressive tailspin. He had been stunned by the band's decision to retire the name and close the book, and he was hit with instant financial problems. Deeply in debt, without the band's plush touring income, Welnick was having problems meeting his responsibilities. His world was becoming unraveled. On the 5-hour daytime ride from Santa Barbara to Santa Cruz, Welnick retired to his bunk about 45 minutes into the drive. When the band arrived for the sound check at the concert, Welnick didn't show. Weir sent someone to wake him up, but the roadie returned without Welnick. "He's hard crashed," he told Weir. "I can't wake him." Weir knew instantly what had happened. Calmly, he told the roadie to call an ambulance. The paramedics arrived and found an empty Valium bottle. Welnick had taken 57 pills, the entire contents of a fresh bottle, and went to the hospital accompanied by the roadie. The band returned to the sound check and the concert. Welnick never played with Rat Dog again. He had violated one of the unspoken laws of the road. In the world of the Grateful Dead, it was permissible to be weird, but only so far. Suicide attempts on the band bus, no matter how lame, were over the line. Chapter 3. Johnny B. Goode. Weir had determined that playing music as hard as he could was the only way to deal with Garcia's death. After finishing the Rat Dog tour in December and taking an uncharacteristic month-long vacation traveling in Southeast Asia, Weir hit on a truly inspired idea for bolstering the blues bottom end of Rat Dog, recruiting a new pianist, one of the founding fathers of rock and roll, 72-year-old Johnny Johnson. This little-known figure chiseled a huge mark in music history as the musical partner of Chuck Berry since the beginning of Berry's career. He helped fashion young Berry's music and provided a sturdy boogie-woogie framework to all Berry's storied 50s hits. Chapters of the rock and roll Bible like Maybelline, School Days, Rock and Roll Music, Johnny B. Goode, and Roll Over Beethoven, a collaboration that lasted for the 20 most productive years of Berry's career. Johnson, who was never accorded the recognition or songwriting credits Berry enjoyed, was working as a bus driver in St. Louis when his obscurity was disturbed by his role in the 1987 film Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. In the movie, Keith Richards conducted a 70th birthday celebration concert for Berry and featured Johnson, dragging him out of Berry's shadow for the first time. Johnson subsequently enjoyed a modest late-career reprise with concert appearances and new recordings, featuring him playing with an array of musicians such as Eric Clapton, John Lee Hooker, Bo Diddley, and George Thorogood. Rat Dog's Matt Kelly contacted Johnson, whom he knew from blues circles, and he joined the band in rehearsals at Weir's Treehouse Studio in his Mill Valley home. Johnson had never heard of the Grateful Dead, but Weir and the rest of the band loved having this deep connection to the heart and soul of rock and roll playing in their band. Johnson was the master of playing a left-hand shuffle against a straight eight with the other hand, the very basis of the original rock and roll style. Weir was thrilled to be learning at the feet of the master. Johnson made his Rat Dog debut at a raucous Mardi Gras show in February 1996 with New Orleans's Neville Brothers at the great Henry J. Kaiser Auditorium in Oakland, sentimental scene of so many great Dead shows. With bluesman Taj Mahal sitting in, as well as the Nevilles joining the set opening Iko Iko, Rat Dog celebrated the band's new member by playing his tune Tanqueray from one of his recent solo albums and Promised Land from his days with Chuck Berry as the encores. In April 1996, Weir was still the only band member doing public performances when three of the former Dead members finally took the stage together for the first time since Garcia's death to play music. Both Lesh and Weir joined Bruce Hornsby in his concert at the Fillmore. Weir strolled on stage with a guitar in the middle of Sugary. Three songs later, Hornsby brought out Phil Lesh for Truckin'. The crowd cheered ecstatically when those voices blended on the opening line. They stayed for Turn On Your Love Light and Not Fade Away before returning with an encore of the band's The Wait. Unlike Weir, Mickey Hart hadn't been grieving in public. Like Weir, Hart also dealt with his grief by burying himself in work. He went into hiding, sequestering himself in the vast recording studio at his 50-acre Sonoma County ranch, where he was finishing a massive recording project, already more than 3 years in the works when Garcia died, tens of thousands of dollars over budget, and ambitious beyond anything the fearless, ferocious drummer ever dared attempt. Hart trained his intense intellectual curiosity on his bliss. The project began as an excursion of his Grammy-winning 1991 Planet Drum album, an all-percussion collaboration by a group of percussionists drawn from different cultures that would become the biggest-selling world beat album in history. The Dead drummer had a long history with his own independent recording projects. He made his first solo album, Rolling Thunder, in 1972, and over the years did extensive recording work as an ethnomusicologist with Egyptians, Indians, and even New Guinea rainforest dwellers. He wrote best-selling books about percussion throughout world cultures. He composed and recorded portions of the soundtrack to Apocalypse Now for director Francis Ford Coppola. He was scheduled to lead a team of more than 100 drummers playing his compositions at the opening ceremonies of the 1996 Olympic Games that July in Atlanta. Hart and associates Zakir Hussain, Giovanni Hidalgo, and Sekuru Adepoju began recording the Planet Drum follow-up in 1992. When the Dead were not on the road, he would hole up in the studio, recording extensively, almost compulsively. He logged thousands of hours. When dead lyricist Robert Hunter joined the project, writing songs to skeletal percussion tracks, the album began to take a different direction. Garcia had recommended The Mint Juleps, six Jamaican sisters he saw sing on a Spike Lee-directed PBS special. Now, Hart moved them into the ranch and submerged them in the madness. He had them sing some songs hundreds of times, saving each version to later painstakingly assemble impossibly intricate composite vocals, what studio professionals call gnat surgery. He filled more than 250 tape reels. There were more than 1,500 tracks recorded. Hart was awash in the music, lost in a sea of takes. He plowed ahead furiously after Garcia's death, often breaking into uncontrollable tears in the studio. Once when recording an overdub with drummer Carter Buford of the Dave Matthews Band. Hunter showed up at the studio with a new song. Uncharacteristically, he insisted on singing the rough vocal. He refused to allow anybody to see the sheet of paper with the words written on it. The song was called Down the Road, and it envisioned encounters with a procession of fallen heroes. Joe Hill, John F. Kennedy, John Lennon, and Martin Luther King Jr. The King verse never worked out to Hunter's satisfaction, so he had recently substituted a new final verse. When the smoke and thunder cleared, enough to look around, I heard a sweet guitar lick, an old familiar sound. I heard a laugh I recognized come rolling from the earth. I saw it rise into the skies, like lightning giving birth. It sounded like Garcia, but I couldn't see the face. Just the beard and glasses, and a smile on empty space. When Hunter finished his vocal, everyone in the control room was weeping. The album was growing into a magnificent animal, something far beyond any of Hart's previous works. Bruce Hornsby, who put an accordion part on Down the Road, told Hart it sounded like soul music to him, and he should contact Robin Miller, the British producer behind the Europop pseudo-soul hits by songstress Sade, Smooth Operator. Miller miraculously pieced together a supple final mix from the chaos, and Hart prepared to take the Mystery Box Band on the road after the album's June release. Like the rest of his bandmates, Hart saw this transition as an opportunity for a clean break with the past. Like Weir, he was intent on reinventing himself. I don't have to be Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead, he told the San Francisco Chronicle. This is a breakout, new energy, a new horizon. It's new growth, new life. It's not a retread. I'm not going to play songs like the Grateful Dead. In fact, I went out of my way not to sound like the Grateful Dead. I want to keep the spirit, but I want it to be me. No guitars, just drums and voice. The audience is the Grateful Dead now, he said. They've got the power to make it a Grateful Dead concert once the groove starts and the lights go down. The Mystery Box album took on special meaning in the wake of Garcia's passing. No longer some sideline enterprise to occupy his restless creativity outside the Dead. Now the album crystallized as a launching pad for a new musical life for Hart. There was a lot of optimism surrounding the record's release. It had the scent of something almost entirely foreign to the Grateful Dead world, a potential hit record. What do I know about pop music? He said. We're going to find out. I'm not trying to copy any particular style. It's an experiment. If this becomes popular, then it will be pop music. If not, it will be another one of my enthusiasms. 3 days before Hart and Weir launched their respective solo bands on the Further Festival tour in June 1996, the first official performance by assembled members of the Grateful Dead after Garcia's death took place in San Francisco. Weir, Hart, Phil Lesh, and Vince Welnick made a bizarre cameo appearance at a new music festival with San Francisco symphony maestro Michael Tilson Thomas, the celebrated conductor. Deadheads roamed the aisles of Davies Symphony Hall, hung around the sidewalk outside, begging for spare tickets, and filled the restrooms with pot smoke. Even if the band members were only going to play a few largely indecipherable passages in the 36-minute piece, Eager Dead fans mingled with the blue-haired symphony regulars in an environment where they were distinctly out of place, only slightly more so than the Dead members themselves. Lesh, of course, was the source of the infiltration. He had studied experimental classical music in college, under composers Darius Milhaud and Luciano Berio, and maintained an interest in avant-garde compositions. Under Lesh's influence, the Rex Foundation, the Dead's philanthropic arm, became one of the most generous supporters of new music composers in the grant world. He attended the symphony occasionally and came to know conductor Thomas through charity events involving music education. When Thomas proposed Lesh and his associates play the parts he envisioned for a rock combo in a John Cage performance at his upcoming Youth Symphony American Festival, Lesh readily agreed and corralled his colleagues. Thomas planned to perform two pieces by Cage, Apartment House 1776, a relatively straightforward piece commissioned to celebrate the nation's bicentennial, and Ranga, a more free-form composition involving drawings by Henry David Thoreau, with large sections of improvisation. For Ranga, Cage simply transposed stray marks and little drawings from Thoreau's notebooks on a time graph that was intended to serve as the score. It was up to the individual musicians to interpret the marks. The two pieces would be played simultaneously. The cryptic notations Cage supplied Ranga amounted to little more than suggestions by the composer. "When you have 78 people improvising together," Thomas said to the Chronicle, "it requires an enormous amount of imagination. It also requires terrific restraint to listen for the precise moment to play." At rehearsal, the four Dead men were flanked by four vocalists who sang Apartment House 1776, four different versions of music Cage imagined Americans would have heard in 1776, each sung independently of the orchestra and each other. Soloists stood arrayed in the balcony, and Thomas presided over the full San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra on the stage. The first run-through was a cacophonous auditory barrage. Thomas held his fingers to his lips and dropped his voice. "Have the courage to play softer," he said. Lesh worked with the members of the youth orchestra for 2 weeks before the performance, trying to instill some of the basics of improvisation into young musicians trained only to play what they read. "Improvisation starts off with imitation," Lesh said to the Chronicle. "You imitate what you hear and elaborate on what it suggests to you. You have to be listening very carefully. That's what we always did when we were collectively improvising in the band. We were always listening harder than we were playing. Any musical context, a song, for instance, is like a labyrinth. It has lots of branches, but it's closed on itself. And we were always searching for the thread that was going to allow us to find our way out of that labyrinth into open territory, or maybe even another labyrinth." In the carefully calculated 36 minutes, scrupulously counted down by television monitors on stage, the Dead musicians may have played a total of 2 minutes, a couple of squawks on keyboard, some screeches on guitar, a few flamadiddles on the drums, and could barely be detected above the orchestral din that surrounded them. After the unsatisfying performance, Bob Weir stopped on his way home to jam at the tiny Mill Valley nightclub Sweetwater, and played the rest of the night in front of a dozen drunks. A day later, Weir and Hart left for the summer tour. After short, hurried rehearsals in Georgia, the further tour opened June 20th in Atlanta. The show was a 7-day ordeal featuring at least 8 acts and a grueling 31-city march across the country. Instead of the deluxe travel arrangements and accommodations of the Dead tours, the pack moved like a traveling circus in 15 buses and vans, stopping, when they did, at motels and an occasional Marriott. The duration of the show meant crews and musicians spent all day and most of the night at the concert site. Hot Tuna, who opened the shows in broad daylight, often before a scant few hundred fans, stayed to participate in the show-closing jam session at the end of the night, like bit actors in Macbeth, called to play parts in the first and fifth acts. While Bob Weir and Mickey Hart may have set out to reinvent themselves, The producers of the Further Festival, John Scher and Cameron Sears, sought to surround their new incarnations with as much of the conventional trappings of a Dead concert as they could muster. If this tour was about new life for the Dead musicians and crew, for the Deadheads, it was about the passing of Garcia and a combination celebration of life and grief counseling session.